I did have a look, tried to have a look, a quick glance at the rules of D&D online, but the basic rules PDF, which you can find online, issued by the publishers, Wizards of the Coast, is 180 pages long, so I did not glance through that.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Worst Foot Forward podcast, where we celebrate the best of the worst. I'm Ben Vanderveld, and this week you find us on our hands and knees crawling through the underworld. I'm sporting a trash can lid for a shield, a broken broom handle for a lance, and a colander for a helmet after rolling 3 natural 1s on an armour check. Luckily, we appear to be crawling through an understaffed dungeon as we've encountered fire demons made of asbestos, ice dragons who melt as soon as they cry, and a deep, sinister, eldritch evil in the depths that scuttles away as soon as you threaten to tell their mothers what they've been doing. And with me is the ne'er-do-well to my nerd-downer-well, Barry McStay.
Oh, wow, Ben's got whiplash from that pun.
Yeah.
I am so excited. I have been waiting for us to do a really, really nerdy, niche episode for a while, and it's been a while, and this is the one that really tests the loyalty of the regular listeners, who are just like, I'm just in it for the trivia. How happy are you about trivia about the most nerdy role-playing game ever?
All right, so I'm going to... Firstly, I reckon this will be on point with 90% of our listenership.
I should hope so.
Secondly, I'm going to go right out there. So I was very resistant to Dungeons & Dragons for a long, long time.
Yeah.
Because my big brother did it when he grew up in the 70s, and that's a different time when fun wasn't invented. And also because I didn't appreciate what it was. And essentially what it was is it's nerd improv.
Yeah.
It's fantasy improv.
Yeah.
So I have played Dungeons & Dragons for the first time this year. My character is a halfling monk called Osric Panhandle. And
coming soon to the Edinburgh Fringe.
Yeah.
That's Ben's alternate Edinburgh show next year.
And at first I was like, yeah, whatever, I'm just gonna hang around doing Osric Panhandle stuff. And then about an hour in, I was like, I just punched a wolf to death. And I've never looked back since.
I've never played Dungeons & Dragons. We play a lot of board games,
yeah.
And we often sort of play up the role of the character or the thing you're playing in the board game, but I've not done a full out-and-out RPG. RPG is role-playing game, listeners. You're going to be learning so many new terms today.
Yeah, it's one of those things, the more you give to it, the more you get back. But can I just point out here and now, no matter how much I'm now invested in the world of Dungeons & Dragons, if you're a LARPer, you're a fucking deviant and should stay away from all civil society.
And I think we can say that's an official declaration by the podcast.
Yes, goodbye 2% of our listeners. You probably can't hear this anyway because you're wearing elven ears as we talk.
They were only role-playing as podcast listeners anyway. All right, our guest this week is a video game journalist, producer, YouTube host, and performer. He is one quarter of the video team at Eurogamer, the excellent video game review site and magazine. He has performed alongside friend of the show, Paul Flannery, in his show Memorpaga. He has given a TED Talk about the links between mental health and gaming, and hosts the video series Low Batteries about the same topic and how video gaming can be a coping mechanism for those suffering from anxiety, depression, and the likes. Most pertinently of all, though, he is a highly accomplished dungeon master, by which we mean he creates and guides games of Dungeons & Dragons, both professionally and for friends, not that he decides how many lashes of the whip you're going to get from Miss Mayhem, you naughty boy. He's less 50 Shades of Grey, more 50 Shades of Greyhawk. And if you laughed at that, you're listening to the right podcast, you beautiful nerds. Anyway, please listen and welcome Johnny Chiodini.
Hello, how are you doing?
You suppressed the laugh at Greyhawk. I broke that. I learned a place in the world of Dungeons & Dragons specially for you.
I'm so sorry.
Because I love you.
I did appreciate it. And yes, I suppressed it because I'm a big believer in not talking over the cross chat at the beginning. So I thought, I'll wait until I'm actually introduced.
We like to try and test people's resolve enough.
Yeah. to say something really controversial about the thing that they love, and they're like, oh, that's so wrong, but there's etiquette to be stuck to.
Or just leave them sitting there for 15 minutes while we go off on one.
Yeah, well, obviously, Johnny's there just going, oh, I think I'll do a discretion roll. Oh, I got a 6, that's not enough.
How do you become a professional guide and dungeon master and games master?
So, basically, it started with...
Actually, before you answer that,
yep.
Can you tell people what that entails?
Oh, sure.
Again, I'm assuming base level knowledge for some people.
Right, so... As you already said, kind of like a pen and paper role-playing game is just nerd improv. Mm. It's collaborative storytelling with some rules elements thrown in to make sure that you don't get to decide everything that happens, so you're not just telling stories about how great you are, but that needs somebody to be the rules effectively, to call when you need to pick up some dice and roll them. That's the Dungeon Master. Mm. And then my role is one... semi-professionally,
yes.
Is that there is a group, they call themselves the Ox Venturers, yes. And they have a YouTube series where we sort of record episodes in one go and they release them gradually. They're sort of animated. Mm. But we also do live shows, which is bonkers. Like, we did one last week and it was about 500 people watching us play D&D live.
Oh, wow! Amazing. Where was that?
It was at MCM Comic Con at the XL Centre, but done others. Like, we did some at PAX East in Boston last year? No, this year.
In one sense, people go, oh, what a nerdy thing to do. You've all just been watching a series about dragons for 10 fucking years.
Yeah.
Mm. This is essentially people creating their own versions and, inspired by that sort of thing.
What's beautiful about it, so there's a board game called Dixit, which my wife, who loves board games, loathes, because it's a storytelling one, and because she's one of these people who, if you ask her to tell a story or do something creative, she feels like you're putting a burden on her, because people can find that quite anxiety-inducing, and yet she loves Dungeons & Dragons. Mm. She's not a performer, and yet she's got into character. It's something fascinating about the mechanics of the game that it brings a confidence to people who otherwise wouldn't have it to do certain performative things.
Yeah. Something about having the rules to help you decide how your character would behave.
Yeah.
Just really frees people. Sometimes there's that thing of like, oh, I've got to write a sonnet, how difficult. Actually, now you've got the rules, this is what a sonnet looks like. It's easier to write a sonnet because you know it's 14 lines and this is the rhyme scheme.
Yeah,
100%. That is a very highbrow reference. Also, a very 16th century reference. Loads of our bard listeners are going, well, of course.
No, right, thank you, sir.
Yes, however, the mages would go, oh, I would just summon a demon to write the sonnet for me. What's beautiful about the mechanics of it as well is I swear to God that the dice are sentient.
Oh yeah. They've got you'd be surprised how good a sense of humour a 20-sided piece of plastic has. Because sometimes there'll be times where I'll ask for a roll and I'll really hope, even though technically sometimes, say in a conflict or a fight, I'm controlling all the characters that are trying to kill theirs. Mm-hmm. I'm effectively against them. They'll roll for something daft and I'll think, God, I hope this works.
Yeah.
Just because I want it to. Like, there was one time where...
And again, for instance, you go like, okay, the likelihood of this succeed... If this is a really likely thing to succeed, you need to roll at sort of a 4 or higher.
Exactly, yeah.
If it's a really difficult thing, you probably need 18 plus.
Oh, yeah.
Like you say, a 20-sided dice.
Yeah, you can ask for a higher difficulty check, effectively. Mm. But it's just... I think one of the best things about it is that it surprises even the people who are playing it and putting these plans into effect. There was one time where my adventurers were hiding in a church and some people were coming in to try and kill them. So the rogue cast a spell called Grease on the floor, which covered the floor in grease. And the lovely wood elf, who's like true neutral and just wants to be friends with everyone, she, not really knowing what this spell did, cast a thorn trap on the floor at the end of the grease. And she didn't realise how damaging this spell is. And so all of these paladins ran in, slipped, and got minced. They fell into a wood chipper.
Skidded along on this grease, cartoon styly.
She killed like 5 people in one go. Our paladins threw up, like everyone was covered in gore. It's just, they're so unpredictable, even though there's such a stringent rule set.
And that's the thing, because particularly with a good dungeon master or someone leading it, it's really funny. You guys went on a quest and then got stoned or something recently?
Oh, no, that was it. So we went on a quest and uncovered a strange magic sex cult, and we found a cache of essentially poppers from Middle Earth. and we're just wandering around this fantasy landscape feeling high as a kite and loose for anything. my two favourite things from our game is, one, we've got a character who is basically just a nice middle-aged man wandering around with, who does prestidigitation, which is like
street magic.
Yes. Yeah, essentially he's like David Blaine in the body of a quantity surveyor. And, oh, that's the lovely thing. Weirdly, all of us have really high natural charisma, but whenever we roll to speak to someone, we roll a natural one. So we're all kind of like these incredibly charismatic heroes who appear to be autistic when we talk to anyone else. But then my favourite thing, my character, Osric, who is this, I constantly try to pick people's pockets, but I'm shit at it.
Yeah.
So this character who has prestidigitation, he's an academic, so we went to his university to look something up, and we stayed in his rooms for the night, and I was like, I'm hungry, and a normal person would ask for room service. I went down to the kitchen. I was like, right, well, I'll try and pickpocket a chef's hat so I can nick something. I failed in that, so I got caught by a giant ogre. And so the ogre said, what are you doing here? And I said, I'm working for chef, just like on a night off. So he said, why are you trying to steal one of the chef's hats then if you're working here? Like, oh, I didn't realise that... I forgot my own clothes. I'm so sorry. Well, that lie didn't work. So, like, why are you really here? Oh, I'm staying here. Oh, you're a guest. Well, what's wrong? Oh, I just like some food. And she was like, well, there's room service, you dickhead. I was like, fair enough. So shall I go back to it? Yeah, it'll be brought up. And then on the way out, I couldn't help myself. I tried to nick one of the apples. I got caught again. And the dungeon master, as I did that, got the ogre to call out, they're complimentary.
That's a great work.
Honestly, genuinely touching human drama.
Yeah.
Johnny, we always ask our guests what they're worst at in the world. What's that for you?
Leapfrog.
So, in which position?
The jumping specifically.
Okay.
Oh, I'm absolutely top at the
crouching.
Yeah, a solid base.
Yeah.
Frog, great at. Leapfrog, not so much.
The thing is, like, I'm 5'8" and I've got quite short legs. Although they're really supposed to crouch at a height that's appropriate for you. But anyway, my concern is, like, I'm so worried about getting the height that I don't try and go far enough.
Right.
So I appear to be that jerk who, like, lifts himself up and comes crashing down on someone's back. And there was one time I was doing, like, an immersive acting gig once, and there was a dance routine involved in which I had to leapfrog over the woman I was dancing with, and I was really nervous about it. And I was like, oh, I'm really, really not sure about this. And a friend of mine, for the purposes of this story, we'll call him Josh Morrill, because that's his name. He was like, come with me, you can leapfrog me a bunch of times, you won't hurt me, like, we'll get your confidence up. And I was like, okay, great. And I really sort of jazzed myself up, and I was like, I'm going to do this. And I legged it, and started to jump. And just as I started to jump, he deliberately stood up.
Oh, no.
So my left thigh sort of glanced off his back, and I basically like, it was like I was skateboarding. I ground along him like I was, like he was a rail, and I came crashing
sparks
to the ground.
Coming off his back.
Exactly. And I just hit the deck and winded myself and was like, I'm never going to try this again. So that was the end of my leapfrogging
career.
That
is maybe the most Josh Morrill thing I think I've ever heard of.
Yeah, he was laughing like a drain, as you can imagine.
So this week we are talking about the world's worst class, brackets, D&D.
Yeah.
If you've tuned in listening for some exciting class bashing Jacob Rees-Mogg, I'm afraid you've come to the wrong show.
Congratulations on your book launch again.
Yeah. Oh yeah, he sold a really small number of books.
How many was it?
734. Yeah. And there was a beautiful thread on Twitter of retweet if you've sold more books than Jacob Rees-Mogg.
Alright, so I'm going first, aren't I?
Yes, you are.
Well, I feel like it would be useful to talk about Dungeons & Dragons for what it is for people.
Yep.
Formalised by Gary Gygax and Dave Arneson in 1974. I think Dave Arneson had created a sort of a medieval dice-rolling game, and Gygax came along and added in the... Gygax also sounds like a character in D&D, by the way. He came along and added in this fantasy element and all that because he was a big fan of all sorts of fantasy stuff, even though he did claim that it had little influence from J.R.R. Tolkien. But, I mean, definitely Definitely did, when you consider the Tolkien estate came along and said, actually, you have to change the name of those hobbits and, and those Ents and that Balrog. definitely the case. I read that he said, Gary Gygax said in 2004, he gave an interview, because BBC did an article saying, oh, whatever happened to D&D, because it was going through quite a lull at the time in the early noughties. And he said at the time, 20 million people have played it, and it's had over $1 billion in sales. And that was 15 years ago. And it has had the biggest sort of boost again in the last few years. Obviously, board gaming has taken off massively again, which has helped fuel influence in. I can only imagine the rise of superhero films again, and all of that has helped. And the Lord of the Rings stuff and all that.
And YouTube and streaming.
And YouTube and streaming, that's the thing.
Yeah.
Twitch. People watch people play, I think, something like 450 million hours of D&D online or something last year. That's like an insane amount of time. Eight or nine, something like 9 million people played D&D in America alone in 2017, I think.
Clearly they didn't play it alone, otherwise.
Yeah. I read about a guy called Robert Warbo, who apparently has been running a campaign for over 35 years at this point, twice weekly.
This is the super nerd equivalent of these guys who play Championship Manager for years and years and years.
Actually, it definitely is. I did have a look, tried to have a look, a quick glance at the rules of D&D online, but the basic rules PDF, which you can find online, issued by the publishers, Wizards of the Coast, is 180 pages long, so I did not glance through that. Well, and that's one of, like, several, and the thing to say is, like, this is the basic rules of how roughly the game works, but there are almanacs of all the different sort of classes and races in the world, and then you've got sort of, here's a book if you want to set it in the East, or here's a book if you want to set it in this realm, or here if you want to have lots more, like, psychic characters and all this sort of stuff, so...
And what's lovely about it, again, is just, again, to an outsider, it seems, and to people who play it badly, like a really pernickety sort of anoraki train spotty, but I think you'll find that this character can't do this. No, it's just... there, you need this deep structure so that you can play wonderfully on top of it.
Yeah, yeah, that's very true.
And also it's lovely that we now have three Bibles in the house. We've got a Jewish one, a Christian one, and a Dungeons & Dragons one.
The thing that annoys me most about Dungeons & Dragons, though, for a game that is entirely sort of based around dice rolling, the fact that you have to round down every fucking dice roll according to the official rules. No matter if you've got rolls sort of like... a 5.9, sorry, that's a 5 apparently. What a knife in the back that is. And my husband will tell you, I am not the luckiest dice roller in any game that involves dice rolling. Drives me insane. That would really grind my gears. So specifically, classes. Can you tell people what class means in the world of Dungeons & Dragons?
Yeah, it's effectively your profession, really. Although it goes a bit deeper than that. So when you make a character, you pick your race, so you can be an elf and an orc or whatever.
Or
and that
a
gives
human
you,
or whatever, yeah.
Yeah, it gives you a couple of little bonuses. But then when you pick a class specifically, it determines the abilities you have like available to you, especially magic ones. But it also determines which stats are most important to you. Yeah. So if you're... Warlock, for example, you want to be really charismatic. So if you've got subtle charisma, then you really ought to stay away from that class.
Yeah.
If you're really dexterous, for example, you might like to be a rogue because they're really good at pickpocketing.
Yeah.
So it just gives you...
No, we're not.
Just sort of gives you a flavour. So you've got, you know, you've got druids, you've got wizards. So that's, you know, it's your difference between your Gandalfs and your, I guess, Geds from like Earthsea or whatever.
Yeah. It's more like a calling, nearly, like it's what your natural, where you naturally, like you might be, your job might be an accountant,
yes.
But you really, deep down, you want to be a punk rocker, and that's your calling.
Yes, that's exactly it.
And yeah, there are, as I say, all of these people have sort of primary abilities, don't they? So like strength, and charisma, and wisdom, and dexterity, constitution, which I really like the sound of, that's basically all the dwarves who want to eat a lot.
Yes.
Yeah, that's what happened. Another time where we basically...
a lot of Ben's adventures revolve around food, in life and in D&D.
So true. No, another one that we... we nicked some basically Dungeons and Dragons weed from somewhere. But this, by the way, this sounds like it was instigated by me. It really wasn't. But it was the old Prestidigian guy who had anything. I'll have a little bit. And he took one blast did a constitution roll of one. Ooh. And Whitey's out of the cart. we were in like this beautiful carriage, and we basically had to pull into town with vomit all the way down the side of it, and this white-faced old academic going, well, I'm not as young as I used to be.
How was his intelligence? That was the other primary ability. Really high intelligence.
You'd think good.
Yeah, there are some 12 basic classes. It's mm-hmm. obviously, again, we'll talk more about the other classes, but the basic class you can have, you sort of can group them into threes as well. So you've got barbarians, paladins, and fighters. Is mm-hmm. that right? Paladins are sort of holy warriors. Is that right?
Yes, yeah. they have vows, and they mm-hmm. have an order that they sort of subject themselves to.
A paladin was basically one of the knights of Charlemagne's court.
Oh,
and they are, I think, semi-mythological. They're basically the equivalent that paladins are to Charlemagne as King Arthur is to Anglo-Saxon.
Okay. Interesting.
Charlemagne did kill a lot of people.
Yeah. Then you have the bards, the rangers, and the rogues, who are slightly more sort of carefree, slightly lonery characters.
The show-offs,
perhaps,
yeah.
The show-offs. The religious figures, the druids, the clerics, and the monks. Mm-hmm. And then the magic guys, sorcerers, warlocks, and wizards. More on them later. In the earlier editions, they sort of went out of their way to really give you very specific classes. Wow. So rather than just leaving it at the basic, like the first, I think you had three classes in the very first thing. You had the fighting man was one of them. They wouldn't even go warrior or like fighter, like fighting man. He's a drunk in a pub. But then after that, people were like, oh, you could have an Arctic wizard, and you could have all these. And so they went, why don't we write all of these down? Rather than let people come up with it themselves with these basic templates, let's give you this list of all of these things you could be. So you could have things like a goblin sticker, someone who goes around stabbing goblins all the time.
That's basically pest control.
Funny you should say that, Ben. The dwarves had pest controllers.
No!
Yes, they did. The dwarves also had rapid response riders. Who are basically like dwarf first responders. There's also mouse burglars. I love the sound of.
I don't know, are they mice that are burglars or people that burgle mice?
I didn't question it enough. Whichever answer you wanted to be, I feel like that's the answer.
It's the second one. It's yeah. People who are kind of like, I'm going to steal some cheese yeah. from Jerry over there.
And
not Jerry. Jerry doesn't have cheese. He just eats sawdust and breadcrumbs. It's Stuart Little, who's the bourgeois mouse.
If you do want that experience, play the excellent game Mice and Mystics.
Yes.
Which is a storytelling game about little mice. Genuinely, Ben.
Amazing.
And my favourite term that I came across was the mine rowdy. Basically, he's a guy who works in a mine who's there to whip the people who work in the mines if they don't work hard enough.
Oh.
Yeah, he's a miner whipper.
He's a foreman.
Yeah.
He's a guy who Indiana Jones kills with one gunshot.
Yeah. You could be a beggar in some editions of Dungeons & Dragons, which it says you have to be chaotic. Because they're sort of wandering characters and they don't have sort of a stable life, so you have to sort of endow yourself with chaos. Mm-hmm. And also, it suggests that they be inherently immune to both heat and cold because they're living on the streets, which is quite a sad thing to add into this.
Yeah.
You could, in one edition, be a clown, which is basically a bard with none of the thieving skills. It just does, like, you know, occasional roly-polies. Cracks the odd joke.
I'd love to see, like, a clown go up against, like, a 50th class Balrog. Yeah. It's kind of like, I'm going to pull the flags of all nations out of my navel. And the Balrog is like, flame, next.
You could be a fetishist.
Yeah. Oh, I'd love to play BDSM D&D.
Well, you start setting a dungeon, you look up the words fetishist in dungeon and get some great results. Essentially, just someone who worships idols quite, you know.
Oh, right.
Emphatically.
Not someone who just goes into battle wielding a phallus.
Yeah. I liked, you could be a pacifist, who was a class of druid, which they were put out in the second edition of Dungeons & Dragons, Ben, which was the most fighty of all the Dungeons & Dragons editions. So if you wanted to advance your class, you kind of needed to fight quite a lot. So being a pacifist, not the ideal. But my favourite sort of sub-class I've come across is the Anchorite.
Oh, that's like basically a Simon Stylites.
Yeah, it's a sort of a clerical figure, a hermit guy who... They have magic powers, but they have taken sort of a vow to remain in one place. They've gone into hermitage in this location, or they've some religious duty to this location. So in the edition of D&D where they were formed, they would lose their magic powers if they went more than 100 yards away from their chosen anchor. So in a game which is largely about questing,
yes,
that's not ideal.
No.
The storyteller in Johnny is just losing his mind.
It's delicious and horrible all at the same time.
But I, to pick my worst class, I basically went, I'm going to sort of look at one of the four, if you like, subsets. So you have the fighty people, the religious people, the show-offy people, and the magic people. And I've looked at the magic people because essentially, to an average eye, the words sorcerer, warlock, and wizard mean exactly the same fucking thing.
Right, I was good. I'm glad you said that because I was going to ask.
Yeah. In the world of D&D, they are not the same thing by any stretch of the imagination. Wizards are basically nerdy magic users, people who have studied and learned how to use magic. Sorcerers are people who have inherent magic, either inherited from down the family line or something like that. And a warlock has done a deal with a so-called extraplanar entity, so a deity or a magic figure has given them their powers. That still sounds like bollocks. But how do you decide between three really annoying definitions, Ben? Well, you go... You Google the most interesting story you can find about the word warlock, about the word sorcerer, and about the word wizard. So the most annoying answer to these is going to be my choice of the worst class.
I'm calling tenuous metric right
Very tenuous metric. First of all, sorcerers. Wizard's the least cool name. Warlock and sorcerer, much cooler name.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. One of the oldest paintings of a deity on Earth is of a sorcerer. So there's a cave.
Because sorcerers count as deities because they are inherently
They've
magic.
They've got like, magical powers, well, yes.
Like, point of nerd order. But, absolutely hate myself for saying that.
Yeah.
But technically, Gandalf is a sorcerer because he's like a demigod, isn't he?
Yeah.
If you read the Silmarillion, then it explains how he's able to come back to life.
Yes. Good. I'm glad you footnoted that before we got lots of complaints.
I just wanted to show that I've done the required reading.
Yeah. There's a cave network in Ariège in France. Trois Frères, the three brothers. It was discovered in 1914. Dates to about 13,000, 12,000 BC from the Paleolithic era. And there's an area of the caves called the Sanctuary. It's a deep cave filled with 280 overlapping figures of animals, ibexes and goats and horses and reindeer and mammoths and all sorts of things. And topped by a horned god, or the sorcerer, as this painting is called. It's a human with an animal body and large erect penis and possibly antlers.
Sorry,
I'm having flashbacks. it was drawn, and there's a sketch of it drawn by Abbé Henri Breuil, because obviously the caves are, I think they're cut off by the river, so it's quite hard to get into them.
Right.
But there's a drawing of it. But it seems to be dancing and cavorting in a sort of a ritualistic way. And there's a side cave again with an altar with possibly votive offerings in there as well, tools and weapons and stuff. So. Sorcerers, I'm going to get a pass from me because, you know, one of the oldest works of art by mankind seems to, include a sorcerer. So I'm going to let the sorcerers pass, which leaves us with warlocks and wizards. Wizards, obviously associated with the KKK, who have, I've gotten off lightly on this show in the past. Not because we've said they're all right by us, but just we haven't talked about them much. But I thought...
Really, really important footnote there.
Yeah, and will it make the edit? Who knows? But I wondered why they used the term wizards. So I went and looked at the other early names of ranks within the KKK. I read some examples from the first prescripts of the KKK in 1867, the Ku Klux Klan. And they're organized into empires and realms and dominions and provinces, which is basically, if you're America, it's the country, then the state, then the congressional districts, then the counties. That's how they do it. And the thing about that struck me immediately is like hell and heaven are organized on like empires and realms and dominions and provinces and things like that. So they're already getting a bit biblical. So the head of the empire, the head of the KKK, is the Imperial Wizard, who's assisted by his 10 genies. And his Grand Exchequer and Grand Scribe, who basically sound like the secretary and the treasurer.
Can I just go out that the second level of command in the KKK are the genies. They have taken a word from Arabic storytelling tradition to put something in a white supremacist group.
I think he calls them genii, so it's probably from the Latin.
Oh,
like genius.
Well,
I'm definitely calling them genies.
Yeah. I love the fact that that is the point that we're both like, and I'm out of the KKK.
Oh, God.
Yeah. Then below that, you've got the realms run by the Grand Dragon, who's assisted by 8 Hydras, a Grand Exchequer and a Grand Scribe as well. Then you go down to the Dominions, where you've got the Great Titan, Six Furies, and an Exchequer and Scribe. And then the Provinces, run by the Grand Giant and his four goblins.
Good God.
It's really D&D, guys. Forget KKK, D&D is what this all is. Everything. And then you go down to the Dens, which are the most local, like your town, your local branch of the KKK.
Your local neighbourhood.
Yeah, exactly.
KKK.
Just your friendly neighbourhood KKK. Who's run by, the Dens are run by the Grand Cyclops with his two Nighthawks. He's got the Grand Turk, Grand Sentinel, Grand Magi, the Grand Ensign, the one who dies first, and the Grand Monk. And then basic level KKK members are called ghouls.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow, it's... Oh, my God, it's so mythic.
Yeah, they have grand... They have sort of a judiciary, semi-judiciary. You'd have the Grand Council of Yahoos, who would try the officers of the KKK, and the Grand Council of Centaurs, who would try the ghouls. Funny enough, I don't think I'm going to pick the KKK and the wizards, though.
No.
Because... I read about the warlocks, and the first story that I found was about Charlie Sheen.
Is Charlie Sheen worse than the KKK?
This is the eternal question. Charlie Sheen, when he was going through, well, let's call it his rough patch in 2011, kept referring to himself as a warlock, which attracted the ire of the Salem Warlocks. A Wiccan church, basically.
Oh, so I thought that was an ice hockey team.
Yeah. Now, the Salem Wicca witches and warlocks, and they basically held ceremonies praying for Charlie Sheen to be healed, and also asking and asking him to not associate the word warlock with his shameful acts. In fact, they said, "Our ancient ways will not be shamed by your ill deeds." This was a ceremony conducted by a warlock called Christian Way, who is basically a man with eyeliner, bad facial hair, and because it's in Salem, Massachusetts, he and all the members of the church have Boston accents, which sounds fucking hilarious. and they, but also at the end of everything, they went on local Fox affiliate news and they said, "Oh, we, aside from praying for you, you need to have us over to your house so we can cleanse it for you."
Ooh.
So essentially, these are people who they also had to clarify that by saying, "We do not want to hurt you." So these are people who were like, "Oh, we're praying for Charlie Sheen to get better. We just really want to see inside his house. We just want to do warlocks do cribs." I mean, obviously KKK terrible. Source is quite cool. Just for sheer thinking they're quite above themselves and wanting to do an episode of Through the Keyhole hosted by a warlock. I'm going to pick the warlocks as the worst class of D&D characters.
Yeah, there's some notions going on there.
Yeah, yeah.
Although I'm curious just to loop back to the KKK for a split second. You said there are 8 Hydras. Is that 8 men or is that 24 men?
Yeah, it's very bloody-headed.
Do they just all come in one massive row with several
And if one of them dies,
hoods?
Do 3 more pop up?
Yeah. I love the thought of a Through the Keyhole with warlocks. Who would do ancient rites in a house like this? Johnny, what have you found?
Well, funnily enough, I also picked warlocks.
Yes! My ill-informed opinion
matches up.
And there is a very simple reason I have picked warlocks. They are effectively like the one-hit wonders of the D&D world. They are like the Dandy Warhols, where they've got the one song that everyone knows, and everyone is just waiting for them to play it. No matter what they do, it's either that one thing that everyone knows they can do, or it's the other thing. And it's
I mean, I would say that the Dandy Warhols are quite high achievers for one-hit wonders. Please, let's say warlocks are the Chesney Hawks.
Yes,
that's better, yeah.
They
to be honest,
on
the way here, I was like, one-hit wonders. And I'm going to just read out to you this evocation cantrip, which is, it will be familiar to anyone who's played D&D before, because it's called Eldritch Blast.
So
and
this is a magic spell.
This
a,
is, yeah,
warlock
the warlock's best known spell.
What is the chapter and verse for those reading along at home?
Part 3, page 237 of the D&D Player's Handbook.
I start
volume,
with Full House.
Volume 17.
Fifth edition.
Yes.
So Eldritch Blast, it says, a beam of crackling energy streaks toward a creature within range. Make a ranged spell attack against the target. On a hit, the target takes 1d10 force damage. So that it, like, basically, if you're a level 1 warlock, you can take this cantrip, and a cantrip is a spell you can do over and over and over again.
It doesn't sort of wear out.
Yeah, you don't have to rest. You can cast Eldritch Blast all day long if you really want.
Yeah.
And 1d10 is like, that's a, you can potentially do 10 points of damage to somebody in one go, which when you're just starting out in D&D is a phenomenal amount of damage.
Yeah.
So when the chips are down, the warlock's gonna break out Eldritch Blast.
Yeah.
But the thing is, because warlocks have this pact with a deity, like the warlock in the group I run, she literally has a pact with Cthulhu, who now is a weird sort of father figure to her. Like, he pats her on the back with tentacles and stuff. It's all got a bit weird.
He once gets... and then sticks to her.
yeah, he sort of then just sort of gimbals her around for a bit.
Poor Cthulhu can never release a hug.
It's yeah.
always, and people are like, why is Cthulhu being so like creepy with these awkwardly long hugs? These suckers don't let him release you.
He's just shrieking in his city under the sea.
I just love it if you could create a god that is half Cthulhu, half Midas. Everything he sticks to turns to gold, and he's just clanging around with all of these gold
like
objects.
Like a Mr. T figure.
Yeah. Hip-hop tentacled god.
Clang da dang dang. But so, like, Eldritch Blast is something you can get really early on, and because it's kind of, it summons dark energy, basically, it's really cool, and, like, enemies will explode when it's used on them, but it just means that no matter how many spells they use, everyone's just waiting for the warlock to do it.
Yeah.
When we do live shows, the crowd will start chanting Eldritch Blast at the slightest sign of provocation. It's like the barman was a bit sniffy when he handed over a drink. Blast him in the face! And the worst part is...
this is like, for a football fan, that one footballer who once scored a 35-yard top corner, and every time he gets it, the crowd goes, you know it's just going into the nearest park.
Well, the thing is, I'll read you the rest of Eldritch Blast in just a second, but there are other spells that warlocks can do, like Poison Spray and...
Weed Killer,
Eye Bite and Finger of Death, Demiplane, Dominate Monster... Power Word Kill! And everyone just wants Eldritch Blast. Because the thing is, the other half of this is, the spell creates more than one beam when you reach higher levels. So 2 beams at 5th level, 3 beams at 11th, and 4 at 17th level. So you can basically do this incredibly powerful spell, and you can augment the damage to make it an agonising blast if you really want to. But you can hit 4 people when you're a bit of a higher level. So you never escape it. It's the song that keeps getting re-released. Mm. It's like if Chesney Hawkes put out a new album, but the record label insisted on having a really hot remix of the one and only one. Everyone's wanted to hear that. They are completely incapable of escaping this one spell. So being a warlock is...
sad.
Yeah, I genuinely think it's a bit of a prison.
Yeah.
Because everyone judges your every move based on what it is you didn't do. And if it's not Eldritch Blast, there's some part of them that feels unsatisfied. So for me, I just think warlocks are really tragic figures. Not as tragic, to be fair, as wizards, who are the only ones who have to study for their magic ability. Can you imagine being one of those guys? It's like, I'm level one, I've been studying for 40 years, so I can cast this handful of things, and the warlock's just there, like, Eldritch Blast, blowing things up their front centre. Like, don't get me wrong, of the magic users, the warlocks are the show-offs.
Yeah.
But they're also, they're kind of like, what's that joke? It's like, but Doctor, I am the great Pacini. That is them. They are the sad, famous clowns of D&D.
That's why I quite like the wizards, because the wizards have had to work bloody hard to get where they are.
Yeah. Oh, if I were playing a wizard, I would play them like incredibly hoity-toity.
They're the working class raised Tories.
Yeah.
Where the warlocks are. The warlocks inherited their wealth.
The problem is that wizards, like 20 years ago, wizards would be like the kindly, benevolent academics. They would be like Bertrand Russell, but with a staff of power. And now, I fear that because they had to study so hard, but they're a bit full of themselves, they would be Jordan Peterson.
Like,
I'm going to empower you through the power of misandry.
Do you have a favourite race? Because obviously you can play different races. If you were, I know it's a tricky... Oh, you're about to talk about races.
No, I'm just not enjoying that question.
Do you have a favourite race of D&D mythical, not-human characters?
There we go. It's
to
very
combine
important
with Warlock.
That you allied all of that in one sentence.
Yeah.
Specifically in the realm of Dungeons & Dragons, my favourite race is... that's a good question. I'm very fond of a half-orc, because people, they can... they're literally semi-misanthropic. People don't know fully whether to trust them, but they can move well enough in human circles. I think they're interesting.
Yeah.
Personally, I always just play dwarves because I've got a beard, I like to drink, and I bear grudges really easily. That's me. But yeah, like I big up the half-orcs, basically. I think they're good fun.
Can you have a half-orc warlock?
You could, yeah.
What would you, as a storyteller, imagine a half-orc warlock would bring to the party?
Being a half-orc is all about trying to conquer your more sort of like your orcish side, your sort of your more aggressive, rage-filled.
So anger management. So he's just blasting people left, right, and centre, and you're like, okay, it's actually getting a bit old, the Eldritch Blast.
Yeah, well, actually, yeah, I think if I were to play a half-orc warlock, I would make my whole thing that I'm trying to be a better person.
Yeah.
Orc person, and I would try not to cast Eldritch Blast as a way of just bucking that trend.
Yes.
Like, we're not going to play it, we can't be bothered. You've got it on CD at home. You know what it's like. Also, I'm a half-orc, so I'm really strong. I can probably do more damage if I just smash something with a mace.
So. Yeah, I like it because they're quite misanthropic. It's that for half-orc warlocks, it's basically creep, isn't it? That's what it is. It's just play creep. Over and over.
Yeah.
I feel you've got it up against you here, Ben.
So, I'm going to go
straight... Unless you picked warlocks as well, in which case, first time ever we'd have a full house on the show.
Beat me to the joke, but not to the truth.
Oh no, damn it!
So I had a brief little look at things like social class, divisions within it. So there's a phrase that I've literally heard in the news a couple of days ago that goes back to the early 20th, late 19th century, called the man on the Clapham Omnibus, which I'd never heard before, and it's basically used in English law to sort of, it's a posh English law version of Joe Bloggs, or of your American John Doe.
Yeah, you're the common man.
Yeah, it's a hypothetical, ordinary, reasonable person, and how they would respond. The term is introduced during the Victorian era. The route of the original Clapham Omnibus, Route 88, was sort of considered to be the route that the average man would take.
They use it in court cases for sort of going, would someone reasonably expect not to have been burnt by this thing?
Yes.
It's to indulge those sort of like a lot of litigation, litigious cases like that, where they go, okay, you fell off this swing, but actually... Is it reasonable of you to expect there to have been a supervisor supervising you to make sure you had both hands on the strings and so on?
There are versions of it worldwide. In Australia, the Clapham Omnibus has got various expressions. In New South Wales and Victoria, it's the man on the Bondi tram or the man on the Bourke Street tram. In Western Australia, it's the man on the Prospector to Kalgoorlie.
The Prospector to Kalgoorlie.
Yeah. In Hong Kong, it's the man on the Shao Kiwan tram.
Nice.
So, I mean, I'd like to think, I didn't fully look into it, but that is repeated all the way round the former empire.
All in some sort of various form of tongue twister as well.
Yeah, yes, they are. I then looked into the world of, I guess, the historical homeless. I looked into the word vagabond.
Oh, cool.
So, vagrant and vagabond come from the same word vagari, which is the Latin for to wander. It's also derived from the Latin vagabundus, and obviously there's the man on the begging by the Clapham vagabundus. And the idea of the undeserving poor has been around forever. It's really until the Joseph Rowntree Foundation came along and went, do you know what, if you're poor, maybe it's not your fault.
Yeah.
Maybe the chips are stacked against you. But in medieval times in England and Wales, the Ordinance of Labourers in 1349 made idleness... unemployment, an offence, and if you were someone who could work but chooses not to, then you would be either branded or whipped.
What the Tories call the good old days.
Exactly.
It's funny you say that, because in D&D, a lot of the heroes are aristocratic, the humans certainly, which is so much so that one of the editions introduced the peasant hero, because essentially, if you want to be able to get up the ladder in D&D, you kind of need to have connections and a bit of money. And
the peasant heroes, like the guy from our Monarchs episode, Ivalo the Cabbage, who's the peasant king.
Yeah, that's right.
I'm glad to say Osric Panhandle, he is a very much a working class monk.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear it. Working class monks, they've got shaved heads, wearing tracksuit hoods up.
Other vagabond acts, under Edward VI, if you are an idler, the master has the right to force you to do any work, no matter how vile, and he can force you with whips and chains, a little bit BDSM. And if you're absent for a fortnight, you're condemned to slavery for life and branded, not Brendered.
Branded. Bring out Brenda.
And Brenda talks to you for an hour after you brand yourself. You're branded with the letter S. If you run away 3 times, you would be executed.
What if you run away a 4th time? Let them try and execute you while you've done that.
They bring you back to life and execute you again. If you've just been idling for 3 days, then it's just a branding of a letter V on your breast.
Okay.
So it's
brutal. Yeah, sure.
Really?
Your wife's a tattooist, isn't she?
She is.
She probably had a lot of business back in the old days.
Yeah,
you should branch out into branding.
Yeah, of course. Oh, so you're basically a sketchbook.
I am, effectively, yes.
I also looked at the history of hobos in America, and hobos are sort of a specific class of a vagabond who go across the railroad network there. And there's various places where the word hobo could come from. The author Todd DePastino suggests it's come from the term hoboy, literally meaning farmhand.
Or the sound they make as a train comes towards them. Hoboy!
Yeah. Bill Bryson thinks it's actually more like a greeting, as in, ho, boy! Or it could come...
It's what prostitutes and rent boys say to each other.
There we are.
In the street.
There we are. We're waiting for it to happen, and now it comes. Or it could be a shortening of homeward bound. Or H.L. Mencken thinks it comes from homeless boy.
These are all excellent ideas.
It's really
Which
fun,
one's
isn't
the
it?
True? It's like call my bluff.
Yeah. They're all
true.
There's also specific classes within them. So a hobo is simply a migrant labourer, whereas a tramp is someone who doesn't work but travels, whereas a bum is someone who neither works nor travels.
I didn't realise there was a distinction.
Yeah. It's estimated in the 1930s there were upwards of 700,000 hobos in America. And then in the 1980s there were still a good 20,000 living that itinerant life. Because obviously America's got this tradition, the sort of Henry David Thoreau tradition of living in the wilderness. But these guys are living in between like the true wilderness and the urban wilderness.
Yeah, yeah.
It's very easy to romanticise this because they are in with like travelling salesmen, travelling poets, travelling songwriters. And people like Woody Guthrie and Bob Dylan plug into that itinerant lifestyle. Yeah. And Bukowski as well, but he was much more of a dickhead. But there's things that there's a culture build up around, for example, this hobo slang. Some of my favourites are a barnacle, who is someone who sticks to a job for a year or more. A bone orchard, which is a graveyard. California blankets, which are newspapers.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. A jungle buzzard, who is a hobo who preys on his own. A possum belly, who is someone who rides on the roof of a passenger car because you've got to lie flat on top of it. Or my favourite one, a preacher or a minister is known as a sky pilot. You can see why Dylan wanted to hang out with him, right?
And all of those were subclasses in the second volume of D&D as well.
Yeah.
There's
also hobo signs. So when hobo would sort of basically leave graffiti on the wall to warn hobos come along there, whether it's safe or not. For example, there's a cross signifies angel food, so food that's served at churches.
Yeah.
A top hat and a triangle signifies that they're wealthy. And my favourite one is that a cat signifies that a kindly lady lives here.
Oh, nice.
But I decided that they were far too benevolent and lovely, and I instead picked mercenaries as my least favourite class. So there have been soldiers of fortune going all the way back to ancient Egypt and probably beyond. It's recorded in the 13th century BC that Pharaoh Ramesses II used 11,000 mercenaries during some of his battles. They would come from all over Africa and I imagine also the Far East as well. The Byzantine emperors had the Varangian Guard, who were deliberately picked to be non-Byzantines because there was so much fratricide and assassination. And this is one of the favourite facts I've ever discovered. The Varangian Guard were all chosen from war-prone peoples, and the preferred people in the Varangian Guard were the Norsemen. So you've got in sort of 8th, 9th and 10th century Istanbul, you've got Norwegians coming down and serving there.
Yeah, looking beautiful.
Blonde hair, blue eyes and a lovely tan.
Oh, yes, please. One of the most famous guards of the Byzantine emperors was Harald III of Norway, known as Harald Hardrada.
Ah.
And we know him over here because he was the guy who died at the Battle of Stamford Bridge in 1066, which happened just before King William the Conqueror came over and beat Harald Godwinson in the more famous Battle of Hastings.
Amazing.
So I love that just before he got his ass kicked over here, he was moonlighting as a bodyguard.
Massively well-travelled as well.
Yeah. Just so this notion that we live in a global world being a modern phenomenon is again, total bollocks.
Interrailing around Europe, doing his work experience.
There's also the mercenaries sort of had a resurgence in the medieval and Renaissance times. Mm. The most famous of them were the White Company. You had these free companies who basically wandered around being swords for hire. And this is why I don't like them, is because they are show no loyalty to anything but the coin, and why they're very dangerous to employ.
Yeah, you're more of a paladin type, you know, sacred vows, loyalty, all of that.
And they, you know, and they worked particularly for loads of the Italian city-states, and they worked for the Pope.
The condottieri.
Yes.
That's what they call them.
But the greatest warning about them comes from Niccolo Machiavelli in The Prince, who says that you really shouldn't use them because their sole motivation is their pay. They won't be inclined to take the kind of risks that can turn the tide of a battle in case it costs them their lives. Mm. He also says that a mercenary who fails is clearly no good, but one who succeeds might be even more dangerous because he pointed out that a successful mercenary army will no longer need its employer if it's more military powerful than its supposed superior. So that explains why there were frequent betrayals.
Yeah.
And also, if you don't pay them, as happened often in the Dutch Rebellion, Philip II of Spain constantly got in trouble whilst trying to repress rebellions in the Netherlands, because there would be these huge sieges and they'd be like, mate, we've been laying this city to seed for months and months and months and years, can you please pay us? And he'd be like, I've got no money. And they're like, you own South America. You have all of the gold. But I'm trying to rule Europe. I'm like, bad luck, mother. And they're like, I would turn against him.
Wow.
I'm just going to tell you about, there is, I retweeted it last night, an incredible wiki list of mercenaries throughout the ages. And I think we are going to have to do a world's worst mercenary.
I think we're going to have to dig down.
But just an example of some of these awful humans. Diogenes of Judea. Who fought for the Hasmonean kingdom. He was a Jewish soldier in the service of Alexander Janneus, and he was responsible for crucifying 800 Pharisee scholars in front of their families.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, a bit of an inspiration for Daenerys Stormborn there.
Still a crowd there, though.
Yeah, yeah.
800 people, their families, you know, maybe 4 or 5 in the family. That's a good,
Yeah.
3,000 people or 4,000 people.
Yeah, that's fair enough. He's, you know, he knows how to pull a crowd.
Yeah.
Eustace the Monk, friend of the show.
Yes, Eustace the Monk.
Is
pirate.
Is in there. Purely for his name, I've picked a Swiss mercenary called Arnold Winkelried. But he was a notorious mercenary leader in the 16th century. He instigated Cardinal Scheiner to engage in a skirmish that led to the disastrous Battle of Marignano, that basically made that cardinal lose all of his power. Roland York, who was an English soldier of fortune, who fought for the Spanish Netherlands in the 80 Years' War, which are the ones I was just talking about, but he betrayed his leaders and turned over his fee to the enemy and offered all of his service to the enemy instead.
Charitable.
Yeah. George Washington Dixon, a singer and stage actor, who also fought...
what are we but mercenaries to the stage?
Yeah. took part in a filibustering expedition, and a filibustering expedition is one that has no political authority, to the Yucatan in Mexico, and also one of the earliest blackface performers. So he can get to fuck.
Double whammy.
And then by the end, you have some people who are leading ridiculous lives, including Carl Gustav von Rosen, who was a mercenary pilot for Finland during the Winter War, and Nigeria during the Biafran War.
Wow.
There's Fred Marafeno, who's a Fijian-born British Special Air Services pilot who fought in the Sierra Leonean Civil War.
Nice.
possibly my two favourites, Josiah Harlan, who's an American adventurer who travelled to Afghanistan and Punjab with the intention of making himself king, and is the inspiration for the Kipling story,
oh, yeah,
The Man Who Would Be King.
Yes, yeah.
But the most amoral of all mercenaries was Henry McIver, an American soldier of fortune who fought for 18 different countries in a 27-year career.
Wow.
What a journeyman that guy is.
Yeah. Well, well done to humankind, you know, as well, for having that many wars going over a course, yeah, of that time. It's, yeah, good. Good providing employment.
Yeah. He was presumably negotiating his next contract while fighting.
Yeah. Right? He was being tapped up like footballers.
So busy. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, he was the Dean Windass of mercenaries.
I guess what we've learned is if the man for whom the word Machiavellian is named is advising that it's a bad idea, yeah, we have to stay away from it. Like, that's not a good thing to be doing.
Good rule for life, yeah, good rule for D&D. Our suggestions for the world's worst class are Barry's suggestion of the house-invading Salem warlocks,
yes.
Johnny's suggestion of one-trick pony warlocks, mm-hmm, the very much the one-shot crossbow of the magic world.
That's another subclass, the pony warlocks.
and... I just love to see them in like a donkey derby, just this little magic man riding along Blackpool Beach. Well, my suggestion of the amoral swords for hire mercenaries. This is hard. I'm gonna immediately take myself out of this because, oh, I mean, I voted 2-1, and whilst I despise the morality of mercenaries, and our pal Niccolo Machiavelli goes, they're wrong'uns. And I'm a pacifist,
yeah,
but they're super cool. Just they are lives lived, yeah, less ordinary.
The old classic.
So I'm
terrible, but it's cool.
Yeah, I'm torn between your warlocks, Barry, and your warlocks, Johnny.
Mm.
And I think I'm going to go with Johnny's for a couple of reasons. Firstly, because you made a better case for the KKK.
I did make a stronger case.
And yet didn't pick them, so
we're keeping
you.
A bit like Hitler, we're keeping them in the back pocket.
Yeah.
Neither of them have won an episode yet.
and also because, again, this show is all about heroic failure, and there's something really pitiful about a warlock and people shouting, do the thing. What's it called again?
Eldritch Blast.
Do your Eldritch Blast. And they're like, no, man, I got other spells. Do Eldritch Blast. Okay, blast. So our world's worst class are the Eldritch Blasting Warlocks. Before we go, it's time for the world's worst news of the week, and we go to a McDonald's in Chester.
Are you buying us McDonald's?
Yes, mate, that's the world's worst news, where two friends fell out on a 40th birthday party in a row about a duck that they'd rescued. Apparently, a duck got into McDonald's restaurant, and they tried to help it leave, but they somehow got into an argument about how best to do this, and a fight broke out.
No.
The police were then called and had to use pepper spray on one of them.
Wow.
After one of them lunged for the officer's stab vest, swearing at him, "I don't give a shit about you."
Wow, that's amazing.
Was the duck, yeah, okay?
The duck was, it was available for comment.
Oh. Delicious, deep fried with a Big Mac.
They had to go to Chester Magistrates Court, where, bless them, one of them said, "I just want to apologise for my behaviour. I'd gone out for my 40th birthday party, gone to McDonald's to get some food, and there was a duck." "I don't know how it escalated from there. To be honest, I'm ashamed for the way that I've acted." He added, "This will never happen again. I am not like this." Magistrate Fiona Crane gave him a 12-month conditional discharge and told to pay £85 court costs. Through gritted teeth in an attempt not to burst into hysterics, she said, "I hope this has been a lesson to both of you." The duck, once again, was unavailable for comment. Yeah. Johnny, before we go, where can we find you and what can we find you doing there when we get there?
You can find me on youtube.com/Eurogamer, which is where I make stuff about video games. And also if you go to youtube.com/OutsideXbox or OutsideXtra, XTRA, you can find The Ox Venture and see us playing D&D. And you can see many, many an Eldritch Blast on there. With all apologies to Jane, who plays our warlock. It's not you, it's warlocks.
Smashing stuff. We're all off to every single D&D forum online to ask every warlock to do an Eldritch Blast until we get barred.
Yeah.
Until next
barred.
Time. Barred!
Yay!
We opened with a pun and we closed with a pun. Until next time.
Bye! Bye.
Worst Foot Forward is part of Podnose, the UK's leading independent entertainment podcasting network. For episode archives of Worst Foot Forward and all of the shows on the network, visit us at www.podnose.com. You can also follow us on Twitter via @podnose or send us an email via admin@podnose.com.